this talk is going to be on attachment and its consequences, which I think is not only a fascinating topic, but it is so eminently practical, because attachments basically run our life if we're not aware of them, which is the key problem. If we move from attachment to identification, the ability to see them is lost. So I had asked after the sitting if anybody remembered the childhood rhymes about the little piggies, and I had forgotten. It turns out there's two. There's one about five little piggies and one about three little piggies. And when we were talking, somebody started talking about another one about 10 little piggies, and I was lost with all these piggies. I just... But the what came to me during the sitting, and the reason I asked that is there is this one that is from the Grimm's Tales. Yep.
The Brothers Grimm.
And it's about three little pigs, and one has a straw house, and one has a brick house, and one has another house, and the wolf comes, and he threatens to blow each one of them down. And two of them are blown down, and the brick one isn't. And then they fool the wolf, of course, gets his comeuppance, which is nice. And they fool him, and he goes down the chimney into a boiling pot of water and boils, and then they eat him, which it's good that it wasn't a story about three little boys or girls. It's much better being three little piggies. That's the third person. So what made me think of this is there is a commercial on TV right now that's about an insurance company, and it modifies this old tale, and it says that, you know, there are these little pigs, and that they only tell the part about the wolf blowing the house down. But because they have this insurance company's insurance, they're able to build the house in a much better way, and the wolf tries to blow it down. You know, he's going to huff and puff and blow it, but it doesn't succeed. And he's huffing and puffing and blowing and blowing and blowing. And so in this story, rather than getting his comeuppance by being cooked and eaten, he's a very adaptable wolf. And he goes to work on a wind farm. So he huffs and puffs and, you know, turns the wind turbines, right? And so he actually has a full-time job now and isn't interested in going out and, you know, catching little piggies, because he can go to the market and actually buy what he wants to eat. So I thought that this was an interesting adaptation, and also actually a pretty good little Dharma story, because in many of our areas of Dharma practice, what are we doing? We bump up against something, and the key element is we have to be flexible and adaptive. You know, if we don't have this open, spacious mind that's flexible enough to see into the depth of the situation and then make some kind of rational choice that actually leads to satisfaction and happiness, as opposed to, well, here's an alternative, and now I'm just suffering from that alternative, you know? And this is certainly, and then another version of that is that we transmute the energy, you know, of anger into caring and kindness, and, you know, there's a whole series of these practices. So this issue of adaptability and flexibility, I think, is particularly important with attachment because of the nature of attachment, and both the Sanskrit and the Pali words that we translate as attachment have the qualities of talking about grasping for something, or grasping for it and getting hold of it, and then holding it and not willing to let go. Okay, and probably from your own experience, you can think of anything that you know that emotionally or intellectually conceptually. You've affiliated yourself with, and then it's become important to you, or you identify with it. That it has a very distinct energetic quality to it. Because what's actually happening is that the mind and or the heart are doing exactly that. They're reaching out for something and getting a hold of it. And so there is this initial energy of the grabbing and then the holding on. And that holding on is a sense of constriction. And we can feel that in our body. So when we move through this, I have an experience, and you know, like you're at the library, or you're in a coffee shop, or a restaurant, and you know, you hear somebody, you know, hitting their pen or their fork or something, and you know, you just happen to notice it, and then the second time you notice it, you know, it's kind of unpleasant, and the third time you notice it, it's kind of annoying, and then the fourth time you notice it, you notice you're kind of getting really irritated about it, and then so this just keeps going, and then pretty soon, you know, the mind just keeps doing this, right? And you can feel that, and then pretty soon, where that goes, if we don't catch it and do something with it, the mind goes, why is that person doing that to me? Right? Yeah, I mean, the mind personalizes it. So This is the part that I love about this practice of it being body-based. That to the degree that we can, and the degree to which we can heighten our body awareness through this practice, if we just listen to our body, we can identify attachment and even the stage of it. Because it's not like, well, sometimes it is. Sometimes something happens, and you know, it's pre-existing and it's hot material for us. And somebody says something, boom! You know, your mind is locked down and identified, and you're gone. Many, many other times, it's like the tapping of the fork. You know, it's this gradual thing, and you can see yourself getting irritated. And as long as we stay intellectual or conceptual about it, it's actually quite hard to deal with, because what we're trying to do is manage it or control it. But if we're actually listening to our body, it will not lie to us, and it will tell us very clearly how this is ramping up. And we can work with our body first, rather than trying to figure it out and conceptualize it and not get attached and not make it personal. We can actually work with the body to take the energy down to where it actually is workable. So this is the part of working with attachment that I find kind of exciting, because I find the body-based part of this practice exciting, and in at least in my life, it's been transformational. And one other part before I actually start talking about the kinds of attachment is to distinguish the difference between craving as opposed to clinging. Okay. So traditionally, clinging is another word for attachment. Okay. Clinging to something, you know. People will talk about something being sticky, you know. And desire, whether it's I want something or I don't want that, you know, that I have in my life, desire either way, is considered craving as opposed to clinging. So craving, desire, will always be a precursor to clinging, attachment. And one way, many, many ways to think of this, but one way to think of it is that craving is the urge of the mind or the heart for something. You know, it's like, I want something. You know, and it's that, you can, okay. and clinging is actually the response of the mind or the body that's moving out to grab a hold of it. I think it can either be positive or negative. But in one case, something happens and there's an urge. And then the mind or the body acting on the urge in the sense of beginning to constrict, to hold on, is the reaction to the desire or the craving. Okay, and then the pathway of dependent origination, where you know we have an initial experience and consciousness arises that has a feeling tone to it of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and then the next step up is desire or aversion, which is just two coins of exactly the same thing, and then the next step up is attachment. So you won't have attachment without desire. The mind's just not going to arbitrarily grab something and hold on to it. It may not remember why it's holding on to it. Hmm. Right? I mean, we may have learned something very early in life that was self-protective. And it really served us well. And we're still doing it, even though now it's not serving us at all. But someplace deep in our mind, this attachment is so deep, we still believe that it's helping us, and we unconsciously keep doing it, even though if we could wake up to it, we'd see every time we do that, that it's not good for us, and it's probably not good for the other person as well, you know? So, you know, that could be things that we picked up from our family of origin and really, really don't know, you know, or it could be experiences that we have, you know, I mean, like deep premises, assumptions that we operate on. The world is a dangerous place. The world is a safe place. You know, I'm really capable of being good with other people. I'm just terrible with other people. You just, all of those, you know, are beliefs, opinions, attitudes, what have you, that become habits, and then they become deep attachments, and then if we don't see them, they start influencing everything we do. It could be good, it could be not so good, and I'll talk about that. But traditionally, there are four areas that the Buddha defined as clinging or attachment, four areas where we do this. And they're big areas. They're big buckets or baskets. So the first one is basically an attachment or clinging to anything that's worldly, meaning at this conventional level of life. So that could be something, you know, a house, an artwork, a car, a vase that was my grandmother's. Anybody even gets near it, you know, I start to get anxious. You know, they're going to touch it and something's going to happen to it. So it could be a physical object. It could be a person. It's pretty simple. It could be the memory of a person. It could be an experience. You know, I'm an adrenaline junkie. That's what I've become addicted to. I mean, like, you know, this is the old thing. I can't be the person, I can't be the man sitting alone in a room by himself, sitting quietly. I can't do that. You know, I've got to have something that's really juicing me up. Or just the reverse. I'm addicted to being calm and quiet and actually afraid of certain kinds of adrenaline-producing experience. So it just goes on and on and on, and it's in each of our lives we have all kinds of these things. So they could be beliefs, attitudes, assumptions, premises that we operate on, principles. Like, I always enjoy preparing a talk because I start seeing all kinds of things about myself that I haven't seen before, you know, because I'm, my attention, you know, everything's about attention, right? So we're taking our attention, pointing our awareness towards something, and you start, it's inevitable, if you've got even a little bit of practice, that you start seeing things. So what I saw tonight was how attached I am to a particular principle. And the principle is that I want, it's important for me to get my grandson to events that involve other children. You know, I take him to a little gym class and he's involved in a baseball thing, that it's important that I get there early so that he has at least 20 minutes, a half hour, to kind of run around, get familiar with the environment, even if he knows it already, you know, have a few interchanges with other kids. He and I work a little bit, and I have it in my mind that this is really important to help set him up so that when this flood of other kids arrive, he's not completely overwhelmed by it because he's kind of sensitive that way. Okay, so, I mean, I knew this, and I knew this was important to me, but tonight, before I came over here, I had to take him to this little baseball practice. So we kind of do our normal thing. We have this whole little thing that we do together, and, you know, I give him certain snacks that I know that will give him enough energy, you know, to play and everything, and I had to change him, and so we go out and get in the car, plenty of time. Okay, I've got it already. Drive out, and I get to the first major street where I'm going, and the corner where I have to make a U-turn, my opinion is that doing this and making a U-turn rather than going on another street is actually faster, you know. Where I turn normally, there's a lot of cars, but I just turn and I get in this line and I get it, no problem. Tonight I pull up to this turn and the cars are backed up from Howe Avenue all the way across the J Street Bridge. Okay, so I look at that and say, and I'm not going to utter the word that I uttered. And my grandson said, "Poppy, don't say that." But, you know, I looked at that and I said, you know, that's like, anyway, that's five or six lights if it's going to be that fast. You know, and then I'm thinking, yeah, we're not going to get there until they're starting, and which is exactly what happened. So I saw myself just getting, like, progressively more upset. And despite all of my practice, you know, I mean, if it was just me, if I was going to be late, it's like, okay, you know, I can take that. But because it's him, totally different, you know, and I'm just getting so upset and actually getting angry, which I'm not very pleased to admit. But I just really work myself up, you know. So it's like fascinating. You know, here I am for last week, been working on this talk about attachment and huff and pluff and, you know, going to be in a wind farm. And okay, so that's, you know, the first big one is anything at this conventional worldly level that we get attached to. The second one is basically wrong view. Okay, view in Buddhism is this huge thing, and in one of the suttas, the Buddha says the first thing is right view. Basically meaning that we have a template that we understand based on Buddhist causation, that we know how things work internally. And if we don't understand that, we can use a lot of these things that we learn and not use them effectively because we don't understand how the strategy fits with a deeper understanding of the human mind. Okay, so historically, there were six wrong views. And these were, you know, everybody talks about the middle way and you know, it's politically correct, it's, at least in America, that, you know, if you're a Buddhist, you know, you're always kind, you never criticize other people, you know, certainly not another tradition or another teacher. And, you know, well, you know, apparently nobody's, people who believe that have never read the suttas. You know, because the Buddha was, he was not fooling around. I mean, like, he said, you want to wake up? This is the way to do it. And you know what those guys are teaching? That's bullshit. I mean, he actually said, that will not work. You know, that is wrong view. And in the suttas, he actually singles out 43 different teachers or groups and says, all those guys, don't go over there. You know, I mean, you get the choice. You know, it's like, come and try it. And, like, if you went over there and it actually worked for you, I'll be shocked. But, you know, it won't. So he was pretty adamant about it. And in this case, all of those, there was, you know, like, there was a view of eternalism, you know, that there is an individual self that never dies, it goes on forever. There was nihilism. So there were these six different philosophical stances towards life. So there's that. But there's actually a seventh, which is the most important. And that is right view, meaning how do you understand the Eightfold Path, his fundamental blueprint, dependent origination, Buddhist causation, and his fundamental teachings. And the failure to understand those correctly is considered wrong view. So there's actually a sutta where the Buddha says, it's entitled What the Teachings Are Not. And it's a very long sutta. It's a long one. And he basically goes through and says, you know, the Jains are teaching this. Well, that's not Buddha Dharma. And this is the reason why, you know, these guys are teaching this, what have you. And he says, and there's a wrong Eightfold Path. You know, another politically correct thing is to say, well, you know, when we say right, well, actually, we don't mean like right versus wrong. You know, we mean skillful, which is partially true. But the Buddha gives this discourse and he says, there is a right Eightfold Path based on this underlying psychology, and there is a wrong Eightfold Path when you don't understand or not based on that psychology. Okay, so one illustration would be is that if you don't understand what attachment is and how to work with it, that would be wrong view. Okay? So the first one is being attached to people, objects, experiences at this worldly level. The second one is wrong view. And one way to think of this, at least from a Buddhist perspective, is any view that points your mind towards suffering rather than satisfaction and happiness. I mean, that's the, in the end, that is the fundamental place that the Buddha is going. So, by definition, if it actually points your mind into suffering and struggle, then there's something wrong with the template, the view, the blueprint, whatever you want to call it. There's something off. You know, there's some piece that's misunderstood. Okay, the third one was described as rites and rituals. And there's people who try to modernize this. And I think you can do that. But what the Buddha actually meant by that was he had been part of a group, and this is a fascinating story if you don't know about it, and I'm not going to tell the whole story, but he was a group of practitioners called shramana practitioners. And these were people who have isolated themselves away from the community. They were in the forest. They practiced extreme aesthetic practices. And they were in revolt against the Brahmin religion of the time. There wasn't Hinduism at the time. It was the Brahmin religion, which was dominated by Brahmin priests. And the way that you would get free was if you paid money or gave gifts or did work for, in some way, ingratiated yourself with a priest who would then do certain rites and rituals, including killing animals, in secret. So it was completely disempowering. They put all of the control in the priests. There weren't practices for you. And the only way that you could get free was if you paid one of these Brahmins. Okay? And so so there were all of these rites and rituals. And the Buddha said, having somebody else do a bunch of rites and rituals for you will never get you free. You know, that's not going to change the psychology of your mind and your emotions and what have you. So then it kind of broadened out to, like, any one of the interpretations now is any rite and ritual, even a Buddhist one, where while you're doing it, you've lost connection with what it means and how it relates to liberation. So, I'm meditating regularly. But the meditation doesn't involve an intention to develop Buddhist wisdom and experiential insight, which is what sets the mind free. So you're just doing this meditation process over and over again, somewhere in the back of your mind, thinking that somehow this is leading you towards liberation. And if it doesn't include, if its touchstone isn't to generate experiential insight, it's not going to happen. Wrong view. So you're doing a rite and a ritual repeatedly that's based on wrong view, and it may be helpful at a conventional level. It may make you calmer, these kinds of things. It's not going to set your mind free. It's not going to put you on the path to freedom. And then, of course, this is the big one. Is our profound attachment to everything self-referential and seeing everything through a lens of self-interest, and how this relates so directly to the idea that attachment and identification are energetic is, if you just think about it, any strong experience where you've had in the last month where you kind of got lit up or triggered, and what happens? There's this escalation, there's a desire aversion, and then the mind clamps down in opposition to something, or it wants something, and then at some point you go into identification, and you're not aware of this process anymore, right? And so that constriction in attachment begins to separate you from the transaction that you're involved in. And as that gets tighter and tighter and moves towards identification, it moves from this is an unpleasant or difficult experience to I am having an unpleasant or difficult experience. And then right at that moment, that sense, that energetic separation is set in. It's like now it's not like Jerry and I and Margaret, we had 3 little pigs, 5 little pigs, 10 little pigs, So it's like, well, okay, I can handle 5 little pigs, but now I'm getting lost with 10 little pigs. Okay, So the energetics of it relate so directly to the impact and the actual nature of attachment, you know, the physicality of it. All right, so what are the consequences of attachment? As I said earlier, I think attachment gets a bad rap because we only think of attachment as being negative, as most of my talk has been so far, right? So there's another notion, and this is kind of like wrong view, right eightfold path, wrong eightfold path, that we have to understand and really appreciate that having healthy dharmic desires is important. It's important to sustain us, to sustain our determination. And the desire to want to be liberated or to want to be compassionate, if coming from a dharmic place, these are very important. And to become attached to the notion that I am really going to practice to become more compassionate or kind, or the qualities of mind on this little chart, okay, is a healthy thing as long as you know that's what you're doing. So then if you don't, then that can flip to a negative, right? So it can go from, I have this healthy aspiration, which is a form of positive attachment, to become compassionate. And the way that it flips is, I'm in a situation and I'm not compassionate, and I start beating myself up and denigrating myself in the moment, and then afterwards I feel guilty about it because I did something that I don't think was compassionate, and then I feel shame because I'm not a compassionate person. You know, it can just completely flip. So knowing, part of a mature practice, and you know, it's a lot of this is falling on and off the wagon. You know, you have to experiment and make mistakes. But no, I do want to have a healthy aspiration. I actually do want to have an affirmative attachment to becoming a certain kind of person, to moving down the path, to what have you, and know that there is a potential danger to that I have to stay awake to. And once again, if you just listen to your body, you'll know when you're flipping. Okay? Doesn't have to be intellectual. Just keep listening to your body. You feel that constriction, you know something's going wrong, right? You're heading in the wrong direction. So this little chart that on the salmon paper, these qualities of mind, you know, these are three different categories of mind states that are considered to be critical to an awakening. So, you know, I asked that question, you know, to what degree have we actually tried to take these on and develop them? At some point, we have to, this lifetime or another lifetime, to get free, because the awakened mind has these qualities. And before the mind, there's these four stages, and these qualities of mind play a huge role, because just looking at this, why would they play such a huge role? You know, so yeah, I kind of divided them up. There's this first set that have to do with, you know, wisdom, truthfulness, ethics, and intention. And then there's a second that are all heart qualities, right? And then there's this third category that all have to do with specific practice skills that reflect a state of mind, like restraint. So important, particularly around speech. And patience and determination and effort, which regulates all of it. So the importance of these is that they create an internal environment that supports our seeing in a particular way. And in specific, they undermine attachment. So like that whole second category, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, generosity, if those really become part of my life, I may still be holding on. I'm holding on in a different way. Because these qualities change our relationship to what? To how we're relating to objects, how we're relating to people, how we're relating to experiences. And they start to change our values in relationship to those. And then a patience, determination, resistance, those facilitate that, right? So that I start intuitively being restrained, which is part of being compassionate. So once you start to look at these, the more you look at them, and you don't have to have a bunch of definitions. I mean, just sit and look at these. And pretty soon you'll start to see these relationships and how they're all hand in glove. And they all relate to attachment. So that's healthy. And by the way, the residential retreat in September this year is on the Pyrenees. Okay, so that's the reason I divided this up. Last year, the retreat was on the Brahmaviharas. Okay, so this year, it's on the Pyrenees minus the Brahmaviharas. We're still going to do those practices, but the emphasis is going to be on the other Pyrenees and specifically how they relate to practice in retreat and practices in daily life. So I'm very excited about that. I think it'd be very sweet. Okay, so negative consequences. You know, the problem, I think the fundamental problem is that when we have at least deep attachments, we may know about them, but we're not in control of how they roll out. Or they're deep, and in the moment we don't see them because they're so powerful. We only see them afterwards. Or we don't see them at all. And that's part of what deep practice is about, particularly retreat work. It's hard to see these things. You have to be in an immersed, intense environment to see these really deep ones and understand them. So there's a fellow who I like. He's an essayist, an Englishman named Richard Temple, and he's a student of Christian mysticism. And it's fascinating because he's identified these Christian sects that almost nobody's heard of, and some of their writings. And there's an amazing congruence with much of it with Buddhist practice. But one of the things that he says coming out of this study is our fixed inner emotional attitudes are the bricks with which the walls of our spiritual prison are built. Okay. Our fixed inner emotional attitudes, our emotional attachments, okay, are the bricks with which the walls of our own spiritual prisons are built. You know, they restrict our ability. They restrict who we are. They restrict who we think we are, what we're capable of. And then on the other side, the danger of them is that they are pre-existent, right? They're already in place. And so they create a predisposition to reacting in a particular way. And they create a pre-existing vulnerability. Because if I think that, for whatever reason, I have this attachment to the idea and I have this emotional response, that I am not capable in certain areas, or that I am unattractive, or you just fill it in, whatever it is, you hit the right circumstance, boom, that's on the table, and it influences everything. Everything. So this is the danger of attachment. And then the other danger is, most of it, when it's lit up, is we can't see it. So it goes to the question of, like, well, what do we do? So to make a point of how dangerous this is, I want to use an illustration that I thought, if it works, I think it will be instructive, and if it doesn't, it will be just a complete failure. And so I want to be clear that I am not about to verge into anything political. But I am going to use some political stuff because it's so hot and lighting people up, okay? All right, so as I do this, what I would appreciate is I would like you to watch what's happening in your mind and your body as I talk about these things, okay? And just kind of stick with me for it to roll out, okay? So in the last week, two things have happened that people are talking about, and I had a couple of coffees, a couple of lunches, and the people that I met with are on the more liberal side of things and had a pretty strong reaction to these, okay? And I'm assuming that somebody who's on the other side would have equally strong reactions, but from a different place. So the first one was, all this buildup and then the announcement that the current administration in Washington is rolling out this tax plan, this unbelievable tax plan. And the result of it, think of this, okay? The result of this is that we're going to have a 9% growth rate of the American economy. This is a huge figure, okay? So that's number one, okay? Number two is the administration had put out a lot of threats that they were going to cut off all kinds of funding to cities that are known as, quote, sanctuary cities. So San Francisco, being like the ridiculously conservative place that it is, filed a lawsuit and with the press releases and all the discussions said that what was at risk was $2 billion that the administration was going to take away from San Francisco. They have a $10 billion budget. So taking away $2 billion would be a pretty big deal. Okay? So the reactions of the people that I had with lunch and coffee were predictable. About the 9% tax increase, for them, this confirmed that the president and all the people around him and the people who are running the government right now, exaggerated everything, and it's just a symptom of their unreliability and their untruthfulness, and quite animatedly in different ways said that. Okay. And then over with the San Francisco thing, just the reverse, just absolute outrage that the administration would try to do this to San Francisco, $2 billion, and all the damage that it would cause. And once again, just a very clear message for them of the symptoms of a lack of compassion, placing corporate interests and government interests over human, the story. Watch CNN for the rest of the analysis. So I'm assuming that if I had lunch with people over on the other side, it would have been just the reverse, but equally adamant. I mean, it's hard to have, I'm finding, kind of a rational discussion about anything right now, So here's what strikes me about this, and here's the attachment part. The reason people are so upset actually isn't because somebody has said that there's going to be 9% growth or because somebody's going to take away $2 billion. That's not it. Those people are attached to something that's driving their opinions on that. Whether it's fairness, whether it's we have a certain kind of country and, this isn't the country that I thought we... Whatever it is, there are attachments and they're deep. Because people wouldn't be so pissed off and upset on both sides unless they were really attached to something. And this was happening in the election. I mean, people voted for particular reasons, that they felt that they were either excluded or that they were part of a group that was, leading us to the next future. But But that is the surface. There's something driving that. And that's what we're trying to get to, okay? So what happens when that's happening? And here I'm just going to pose the question. I'm not going to answer it. I think there's a fascinating answer to it, to these two. But it shows you what happens when you're attached. No serious non-politicized economist or any competent non-politicized student of government economics or the implication of tax, incentives, deductions, all these things on the American economy would support the idea that there is any scenario where we would have 9% growth. That's just a fact, okay? In fact, you can't find one who's competent and non-politicized, you know, who's not arguing a position, that'll even support like 4, 5, 6%, okay? So the question for me is, well, if that's true, and I'm absolutely convinced, I'm not arguing a position here, you know, I really looked at this, but that is in fact a fact. And if that is, why is this administration rolling out a program and saying that there's going to be a 9%? You know, I mean, the first reaction is, well, gee, they've got to be idiots, right? I mean, it's just stupid. You know, like, what are they doing? It just shows how, well, folks, I don't think that's it at all. I think there's a very specific reason they're doing it. And it blows my mind that I get together with people that I think are really intelligent people, and they're not asking this question. They're just looking at the surface, which is what the Buddha said, right? We just look at the surface. We don't go below, okay? It's like, oh, gee, the fact that they're saying 9% proves all kinds of things. Well, it proves all these things that you're attached to. So I throw that out. You know, think about that. Like, well, why would the administration do that other than they're mentally ill, they're stupid, and they don't know what they're doing? And there may be elements of all of those things. But on this, I think that there's a reason it's being done. So let's go over on the other side. San Francisco. No one who has studied this, who is not politicized on the issue, no one would support the notion that there was any real scenario where San Francisco would lose $2 billion. That's a fact. So this is kind of a problem for the person who's the liberal now. Right? Because, like, well, gee, you know, if the administration does it, you know, they're idiots. And if the lawyers for San Francisco do it, well, they can't be idiots. But then why are they saying $2 billion when that's just not going to happen? Well, there's a reason. And so one of the dangers, in my opinion, of attachment is it just disables your executive function. Think about it. It just disables your entire ability to engage in critical inquiry and to see questions that you should be asking. This is dangerous, because once we stop asking questions, it's all over. And at the core of Buddhism is experiential inquiry. Okay, so attachment disables critical inquiry and it disables experiential inquiry. That, in my opinion, of everything, you frame it that way, and then that's a frightening thing, because then you're adrift at sea. You know, very, very dangerous. So I'm really looking forward to hearing your answers on those two questions, by the way. Okay, so talking about questions. The last talk I gave, I emphasized, and there was a handout, that there's three fundamental. See, I'm still with the 10 piggies, 5 piggies, 3 piggies. So there's three fundamental questions that the Buddha said, and these are repeated over and over again in the Satipatthana Sutra, that we should be asking about everything, you know, so states of mind, experiences, people, what have you. And it's, well, what causes it to arise? What causes it to be sustained? What causes it to dissipate? Okay. All right, so I'm just going to give, like, the real kind of brief answers to those questions. There's only so much you can do in an hour, but then we can look at it later. So what causes it to arise? And what causes it to arise is this slow process and sometimes a quick process of the development of the attachment itself. But once it's in place, it is now a mental formation, which means that it's just sitting there waiting to be triggered through the causation that we know. Okay? So the answer to the question, well, how does it arise? First of all, just from a technical Buddhist perspective, it arises because it's pre-existing and just waiting for the, you know, everything has causes and conditions, waiting for the conditions that will trigger that. And then when those conditions are present, that starts to bloom. If we're aware of it, we can work with it. If we're not, we're just lost at sea. Okay. So it goes back to the most fundamental principle, at least that I'm always talking about, almost in every single talk, about causation. Okay. So what causes it to be maintained? And really, there's two things. The first thing is that to the degree that we don't, the intensity is so strong that we can't manage it in the sense of practicing well with it, then it reinforces itself. You know, every thought, every emotion, every decision either points our mind in one way or the other. So to the degree that we are not managing it well or that we're unconscious, it's just reinforcing the strength of that attachment, which means the next time those circumstances are present, it's actually stronger, right? And then the other reason that it's maintained is because we don't see it. You know, which is the fundamental problem of consciousness. But if we don't see it, can't do anything about it. Okay, what causes it to dissipate? And I'll give the easy answer, and probably I can just say this and we can all leave. So this has to do with attachment, right? Which is holding on. Right? Okay. You just let go. Right, all these talks about, well, just let go. Okay. Well, that's pretty hard. Okay. So you have probably noticed, you know, most everybody here, you know, I know at some level and know that you've been practicing for a while. So if you've been practicing for a while, you know that most of Buddhist practice isn't like if the microphone here is the attachment or is anger. Most of Buddhism isn't that arises, I'm going to attack it head on that's not most of the approaches. Most of the approaches are, okay, I'm sitting in meditation, you know, I begin to modify the way my mind holds things, I begin to modify the way my mind understands things, and I start to have experiential insight, which causes me to understand and relate to all of this differently. Okay, so back to our little salmon sheet. If I'm working on these qualities of mind, these create the environment that start to change attachment at its core. Okay. So one is that we have to develop to have a mature practice and have a mature way to deal with attachment is that we have to be developing our practice not just to solve attachment, but to create an environment which affects attachment, it affects identification, it undermines them both. Okay. And then ultimately, the thing that uproots it is seeing it clearly. You know, Vipassana to see clearly things as they are. So, you know, the only, and we can do this to some degree in daily life. I mean, we can catch things, but where we really make the progress on this is in meditation. You know, we're not under time pressures. We're not under the pressures of circumstance. And we can just sit there and have things arise, and you see how they play out in terms of this, these elements that I've been talking about. And you're not trying to change them or fix them. That's the key part. Or modify them. I don't, you know, if it's in daily life, I feel compelled to do that. You know, it's like generally making a fool of myself and say, I'm just going to continue to do it because I'll learn a lot from it. Well, most of us don't do that, you know. But sitting on the cushion, particularly in retreat, you can just let these things come up and see how painful they are. And you can really begin to understand how they work. So this is the reason that I think taking advantage of our one-day retreats is so important. Just have a whole day, you know, to do stuff. And why, if you're really serious about residential retreat work and you can create the time that becomes a value, that it is absolutely critical to maturing your practice and not suffering, okay? So I just want to give you, on the 20th, we're going to do a bunch of stuff like this, but you've heard this before, but I'm hoping that it makes sense now after this talk in a new way, okay? And this is the kind of way in daily life that you could start doing things to actually see this. So go to the Arden Mall or the Roseville Mall, or go to a coffee shop that's busy, you know. Driving would be great, but you probably wouldn't be able to pay attention to the road. So you want to be in some environment where you can just sit there by yourself, and the fact that you're sitting there just doing nothing isn't going to be a problem for anybody, okay? And where you can watch, okay? So when I go shopping with my daughter, we go out to the Arden Mall, and I just hate going to all those stores. It just drives me out of my mind. So I'll just pick out a spot, and I'll just kind of get quiet. You know, I'll meditate for 10 minutes. I'll open my eyes, and I'll just pick a spot that's like 10 feet. And, you know, my mind, the practice is, I'm just going to watch what happens in those 10 feet. And if, you know, somebody comes in, I'm not going to follow them there. I'm not going to follow them there. All I'm going to do is just watch that. But what I'm going to do is, what I'm really watching for is, I'm going to see what comes into my field of vision, and then I'm going to watch what happens in my mind. And it's extraordinary. You know, I mean, particularly the Arden Mall. I don't know. I don't shop at the Roseville Mall. Okay, but I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, it's like being at Costco. You know, it's just a multiplicity of ethnicities and ages and clothing styles, and you know, some of it's familiar and some of it's completely unfamiliar. Okay, so just sit here and just watch. And if you do this and you kind of use these values, okay, I'm not going to judge how my mind reacts, okay? That's the key part. I'm just going to learn, okay? I'm going to know what my mind's doing. And what inevitably happens, and, you know, I think I'm, you know, a fairly kind person and a fairly reasonable person, you know, and have pretty good values, and I'm just amazed at what my mind does. You know, so like a person will come by and, you know, it's like, well, no reaction at all, you know, or somebody comes by and it's like, wow, she was really good looking, you know. you know, you can just feel this energy, you know, and then somebody comes by like, that blouse was so ugly, you know, and somebody comes by and is like, what could she possibly be thinking with that hairdo? So, you know, that'll, as long as I sit there, that will go on, okay? And so each one of those things, I mean, the fact that, that my mind would actually say, what could she possibly be thinking with that hairdo, is attached to something. There is some value about, well, somebody's supposed to be, you know, you're supposed to be neat, or you're supposed to be, or I don't know what, you know? So every one of those things, and then you, and then if you sit there for a while, you start seeing patterns. And, of course, then it really gets interesting. It really gets educational. So that's what we do on the cushion, right? You know, like, how does that arise? And watch that. And so it's a fantastic thing. So, you know, whether it's on a coffee shop or you're pushing your cart around at Rayleigh's, there's a lot of scenarios where you can do this. So, you know, back to the, you know, the wolf, and, you know, now he's working at a wind farm. I think we have to be creative. You know, it's not like, okay, I'm going to go shopping at Rayleigh's. Well, I don't need to practice. You know, I'm just going to be mindful of the colors of the foods and the packaging. Well, that's nice, but that's actually a very minimal level of mindfulness. What mindfulness is really about is, when I look at those colors, and what does my mind do? Where does that take me? You know, why is it that I'm walking around Rayleigh's and, you know, there's a new Rayleigh's over here, so
yeah.
You know, go over there. I'm walking around and, gee, it's beautiful, you know. And then all of a sudden, I just kind of notice I feel very constricted and uptight. I'm really angry. You know, and it's like, what? Yeah, I'm in this beautiful store. I mean, like, in any other country in the world, they would kill to get into that store, to have the privilege that I have to be, you know, that I'm lucky enough to have, live in the area that I do, and I have the money I do, that I can be there and take advantage of that. And here I am, I'm pissed off. Well, for me, this is a fascinating thing, and it shows me that, you know, I'm not awake. I wasn't being mindful. So we can use these techniques if we're just a little bit creative. You know, we can broaden what we define as practice quite quickly. And we can really pump up our practice, and you can hear from that Arden thing. You know, I think it's a mistake to think that practice isn't, or at least a lot of practice, isn't a lot of fun. I mean, it is. You know, you got to have a sense of humor, you know, and not be attached to it being so serious. It's like, no, it's about learning. It's about knowing. It's not about being serious. You know, you got to have a certain level of seriousness. But that thing at Arden Mall, you know, it's like some of the stuff comes by. I just can't believe what my mind says. You know, you just sit there like, okay, I'm taking a break. I need a milkshake or something. So anyway, so those are my thoughts about attachment, the consequences, and where we might start. And as you know, I always go to 9:15 rather than 9, and it's 9:13. So probably no questions tonight. But I think that my next talk will be kind of an extension of this, and I'm going to leave hopefully a bunch of room for questions and discussions, because I think this is really rich stuff and really practical stuff. You know, this is really can change what we're doing at a basic level. Okay, so I'd like to thank you very much for being here tonight. I really appreciate it on so many different levels, including the fact that I get to be with you and get to be in a place where I feel completely safe, and a place where I can talk about things that I don't have an opportunity to talk about in most other places. You know, that is really what life is about. And may all of us and all beings everywhere be free from suffering and have some true measure of satisfaction and happiness in their life. Thank you.